Welcome to New Books and Biography. I'm Oline Eaton. Today I'm going to be talking to Catherine Livingston about her new book, entitled Lily Pulitzer, Palm Beach, Tropical Glamour, and the Birth of a Fashion Legend. Hi, Catherine. Thank you so much for joining us for New Books and Biography. I wonder if you could kick things off by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Good morning to you. And actually, I had a 40-year career in magazines, covering fashion and fashionable people, society, and particularly my last few books have been about personalities. But 20 of each years I spent at Hearst magazines, first as a staff writer at Harper's Bazaar, then as eventually as executive editor at Town and Country magazine, where I spent 15 years, and some of the best years for that magazine, where we did entire issues on Canadian society, Mexican society, women of Milan, and things like that. So I traveled quite a lot and interviewed many people, illustrious people in design, but also as well in business, society figures like Gloria Vanderbilt, television personalities like Meredith Vieira, movie stars Elizabeth Taylor and Robert Redford. And so I have a lot of celebrity, Tom Landy, football legend, Placido Domingo, the opera singer, Henry Mancini, the composer, Roberta Flack. So I did quite a lot on music personalities. Mm-hmm. I also traveled a lot to places like, I worked with some of the top photographers in fashion and society, such as Slim Aarons, Richard Avedon, Hero, Francesco Scavillo, who did a lot of the beautiful Cosmopolitan covers, but also worked for Town and Country, Philip Dixon, Tim Street Porter, who does a lot of beautiful interiors. He's an Englishman. Harry Benson, Scotsman, who does a lot of Vanity Fair and People magazine stories. And but then I went on to Time Warner and became part of their developing a team of new magazines such as Quality, Leisure, and Health. And eventually I went back to Time Warner again to develop, to be part of a development team of 140 television segments on women's health issues called Your Mind and Body, which ran on CBS television just before Martha Stewart's original show. Not that many people have seen it because it was very early Sunday mornings, about 8 o'clock, but it was actually a very interesting show. And in between, I also did some freelance writing for Gourmet, Condé Nast Traveler, Travel and Leisure, House and Gardens, Connoisseur, and so forth. And did an article actually for The Tatler in England. And an article or two for German Vogue. But in recent years, I've been writing books. Among them was Bed Linen, published by Knopf, which was literally about bed linens. And then I did several coffee table books on eclectic interiors, Victorian interiors. And I had a book that was launched in London. It never had an American publisher. It was called Yesterday is Gone. It was a story of a jet set personality, Rosemary Cansler, much married about 7 times. And two most recent books were In the Spirit of Aspen, published by Esselin, more of a picture book, but also taking the history of Aspen from the personalities who went through the international, the post-World War to big skiers, skiing stars from Scandinavia like Stein Eriksson and the people who started, developed it through the University of Chicago, who started the Aspen Institute and things like that. So it was mostly about Aspen from the personality's point of view. And my most previous book, which was called High Rise, Low Down, was the story of the of who's who in the 25 most coveted apartment houses in Manhattan. And so Well, I guess that's it. I received some awards, the Penny Missouri Journalism Award from the University of Missouri. I received an award from the Marquette College of Communications, from Nina Ricci Perfumes. I did a lot of beauty and fashion writing early in my life and my career, and so forth. I guess that's enough, isn't it? It's a pretty long bio.
No, that's a great resume. So what drew you to Lilly Pulitzer as a subject?
Well, actually, I think society writing is very different today. So many of the personalities are sort of PR-driven, and I was looking for a really genuine American society figure, but who would also have a resonance with the general public. And in those in most recent times, I think there were only about three who reached out beyond their own social status. Those were, I would say, Mrs. Esther, Brooke Esther, Gloria Vanderbilt with her Vanderbilt jeans and her paintings, and she is sort of an intriguing personality. And Lilly Pulitzer, who with her fashions really started, which started out as a snob uniform, but in fact it became a general fashion craze in the 1960s. And amazingly, 50 years later, it has become sort of an American classic. So she does have an enormous fan base, and so I thought she would make I was surprised that there had never been a biography of her, because there was so much around her that was very interesting, the personalities around her. But she actually, it turned out, she resisted having a biography. She never wanted one, and when I first approached her, she told me she didn't want one. But so it is not actually an authorized biography. It was, which is actually better for a biographer, not to have an authorized biography. You have to sort of have to tiptoe around the subject too much. So in a way, it gave me the freedom to do a book pretty much as I wanted to.
Mm-hmm. So what sources were most helpful to you? And also, were you able to interview Lilly Pulitzer?
Yes, I did. And I actually had known her. I had interviewed her for a major piece back in the 80s. I think it was the longest, biggest story ever on Palm Beach. It was almost a 30-page story in the Town and Country with photographs by Slim Ahrens. And however, I had interviewed her before. Town and Country, perhaps almost too much, So did stories on something about Palm Beach practically every other year. And so I was the editor. I wasn't the writer of those pieces, but very often it needed more material as an editor. So I had interviewed her actually over the telephone a couple of times, but I met her in the 80s, in the early 80s, and I was impressed by how, by that time, there had been all these glamorous photographs of her that I had seen over the years with her very good-looking husband. They looked very exotic, and of course, were among the first people whose very richly textured lives, but sort of also with a touch of irreverence that I've seen, you know, over the years in many other magazines as well. So it was interesting to see how unpretentious she was. I was taken over there by a friend called William Hutton, who's a descendant of the original of E.F. Hutton, and she was just she was a working mom. She was anxious to get back to her children. It was around 5 o'clock, and she wanted to go home and cook for her children. But she was fun. She was quotable. She's great with her zingers and one-liners. So, I had seen her a few years later in the late 80s again. She actually knew my husband as a child, so I had that. So she trusted me, but she did not want to sit down and go over, to work with me as I Going over manuscripts, sitting down every day for interviews. She said she was too tired and just didn't want to do that. So she resisted it to some extent, and she kept several times. She said, "Must you do this? Must you do this?" And then I heard from her friends. She was always afraid. She said, "Oh, a biographer's always unearthed something that you don't want to hear about or you don't want the public to know." And of course, she came from very famous families. The general, what is interesting, as you know, she died recently, and it's interesting, people, the media always says she married into the Pulitzer family. Well, actually, she came from much more illustrious families than the Pulitzers. I mean, she came from very old pre-revolutionary stock. She was born Lily McKim, and they were a very interesting family, as were her the family of her mother, the Bostwicks, who started Standard Oil, and her stepfather's family, Ogden Phipps, who was head of the Jockey Club and highly... Well, we can talk about that later, but very, very, very important man who came from, whose family started, along with Andrew Carnegie, what became ultimately U.S. Steel in Pittsburgh. So she has quite a big background herself. Right. And, of course, she married into the media family, the Pulitzers, mm-hmm. which is... which probably enhanced her fame because it was a name that was known.
Right.
It was better known in a way because of the Pulitzer Prizes than all the other families who were quiet rich, you know, American, very sort of sheltered rich. I mean, they did not give too many interviews, but they were super rich. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were actually much richer than the Pulitzers.
So the book bounces around in time a bit. What made you settle upon this structure?
Yes, actually, it's interesting that you asked that. It was very hard to do the structure. And I think by starting at the instance when she becomes sort of a celebrity, still essentially a local celebrity in Palm Beach, and surrounded by all these women who want to be like her. And the book starts out... I really thought about quite a lot how to start this, and initially I was more chronologically, I organized it more chronologically, but then it was too hard to explain who she was and how this all happened. So I wanted to start with a dramatic point, and also that she wasn't just a rich woman, but she had already had some ups and downs, and I had to hint at that, I thought, in the first chapter, because I think writing today to attract even a publisher, you have to sort of get hooked in the beginning of the book today, whether it's a novel or... So I presented her as the it girl of the 1960s in Palm Beach, where when she appears at a school field day and one of her own dresses, but she's surprised to find that all the other women are wearing, all the other mothers of all the children seem to be turned out in Lily Pulitzer shifts. And she's kind of amazed at this, and they throng around her, they want to touch her, they want to say hello to her as she comes down the field. And all of a sudden she's sort of feels like is a star. It's apparent that she is a star in Palm Beach, and so I go into it. How did all this happen? Because the big question is, and I've been asked this by other interviewers, how was it that why was it that these little shifts and almost little nothing clothes with very bright colors, which are sort of euphoric on the eye, they're very happy, mm-hmm. childlike dresses. And how did they catch on with a very sophisticated group of women in Palm Beach, very fashion-minded? But there were many reasons for that. But above all, that she was sort of... she was a girl who had everything at that point, the woman who had everything. She had the most attractive husband. Peter Pulitzer was sort of the catch in Palm Beach. There was sort of a race equality to him. Actually, would go into the fact that he wasn't really quite the glamorous rich playboy that everyone thought he was. He inherited much less money than people thought he did. And Palm Beach is so much about money. So he actually built up his, he used his meager inheritance to buy a bowling alley. Then out of the bowling alley, he eventually around there built a orange groves way in the wild country. His orange groves were never in Palm Beach. They were up in near Lake Okeechobee, near a Seminole Indian reservation. And he was sort of flying up every morning. He did have a seaplane, which made him seem very racy and glamorous. And he would get into this wilderness with snakes and alligators, and it was really wild country, and vegetation even could scratch you and hurt you, red ants. And he built a very successful a series of orange groves. And so she was... I think that Lily was sort of almost immediately perceived. She had everything in a way. She was good looking. She had a good looking husband. She had three beautiful children, had a house everyone wanted to go to because it was sort of a mixture of Tropicana and Victoriana, and yet they were doing all the new dances. There was always someone playing the guitar or someone doing the twist. There were all these dogs, and she even had a pet monkey, she and her husband. They were kind of exotic, sort of Tarzan and Jane, as they went everywhere barefoot. They were very deeply tanned, and they sort of stood out. They were not like their other people in their social strata. They were kind of rebels, and in an appealing way, they gave wild parties. They would party till 4 o'clock in the morning, but they didn't have the staff of servants most other people in these big mansions had. They did everything themselves. They would have their friends come over and chop vegetables and chop. So this is where I wanted to give a portrait of her, but also she was, this was the time until, this was the time the spotlight really came to Palm Beach. Until then, Palm Beach was a place of very, very rich people, but who lived sort of quietly, and everyone knew everyone. No one had to prove anything. So if you had a Shetland sweater with a hole on it, it was sort of almost a reverse snobbery of you felt so socially secure, because Palm Beach has always had, underneath it all, was sort of a social climbing place as well. It has this dichotomy of being having some of the most established people, but also because it is sort of the apex of showing off your wealth, it also has that other social insecurity and aspect to it. So with the Kennedy, it was a Kennedy era, and of course, I wanted to say all this in the beginning of the book, just hint at this, mm-hmm. that Lily was a close friend of Jackie Kennedy. They went to boarding school together. They were not classmates, but they were, Jacqueline Kennedy was a year ahead of Lily, but they were good friends. They also went to the same school, private school, girls' school in New York, called the Chapin School. So they've known each other. And so Lily was also her closeness to the Kennedy family, with all the spotlight coming to Palm Beach suddenly with the Kennedys, the young president who was, and his very chic wife. And all of a sudden, the media was interested in Palm Beach and life in Palm Beach, all of which did not have as much. There were always party pictures about Palm Beach in the past. Very glamorous movie stars partying, but not really the lifestyle itself. So with Lily, all of a sudden, Lily and Jackie Kennedy, this Palm Beach lifestyle suddenly was in of great interest to Life magazine and Time Magazine, all the magazines, Look Magazine, all the general interest magazines as well, because the new president-elect was, that's where he was writing his, Kennedy, John F. Kennedy was writing his inaugural speech, his he was selecting his cabinet, so there was a lot of media interest in Palm Beach all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Lily and Jackie Kennedy went to the same boarding school. I wonder if we could go back and talk about that, because one of the most fascinating sections in the book to me was your discussion of the educational options available to women of this social class at the time, at Chapin and Mrs. Porter's. Could you discuss that a bit? And also just give us a sense of what was expected of a woman of Lily's social class, because she seems so cool and kind of radical. What was, how was that different from what was expected from her?
Yeah, she was actually, she was really a rebel. First of all, she looked very different from her other classmates at Miss Porter's school, which is often referred to as Farmington, because it was in, it's in Farmington, Connecticut. First of all, it was a school, I think her classmates and schoolmates were an incredible group of women to begin with, but it was very conforming. These women were expected to catch a great husband, and they did. Many of them married people like Nicholas Brady, who was Secretary of Treasury for two presidents, President Reagan and President Bush, and they were expected they were not expected to have careers, but oddly enough, most of these women became a lot more than arm candy. They were a fascinating group of women who went there. Among them, Gloria Vanderbilt, the actress, Jean Tierney, who is an Academy Award winner, and later years, and Julia Childs, the food guru. She was a Farmington girl. Barbara Hutton, the much married socialite, but it was actually a very strict school in many ways, and it was. It had a reputation for being a finishing school, but actually it started out to be a much more intellectual school than Foxcroft, which was, you would have thought that Lily would have gone to Foxcroft, which, where you could board your horse. It was a very horsey school, and she came from a very horsey family on Long Island. The family started polo, and they won endless championships. They had horses like Secretariat and Seabiscuits were a part of her world. Actually, more her stepfather's world, Ogden Phipps's world. But she grew up around horses, so. And there was a horse riding. There were a lot of sports, but actually, it was Miss Porter herself was the sister of one of the presidents of Yale. So she it started out a school that has taught Greek, Latin, French, German, but by the time Lily was there, it was also sort of the school for the children of some of the great tycoons of our era, but it was a conforming school. She was quite different even then. She wore her hair in sort of Pocahontas braids when all the other women had page boys and bobs and wore circle pins. She always, at that point, she already had expressed a certain individuality. She was very popular with the boys because she had a great sense of humor, which she did until the end of her life. Even when Lily, these last few months when she was very ill, people told me that when they spoke to her, she was still cracking jokes, and she could speak. As one of her friends said, some of her conversation could make the wallpaper peel. They were so she used such colorful language, and so she was very popular. And she was totally unpretentious. She was a very natural, uninhibited person, but she was not a good student. And I think that might have been hard for her because she was with Jacqueline Kennedy, was an excellent student, very ambitious student, and serious, and so she whether she didn't want to keep up or couldn't quite keep up. She was not very academically distinguished, and which kind of affected her later on, because these girls, many of them did go on to sterling American universities, mostly the Seven Sister Colleges, but many of them did not, you know, because they were expected to get married as soon as they were panicked about not being married. And it was a different time. It was a girl could be, if she was, there was a great competition for these men, like John F. Kennedy, they dated people like John Cassavetes, the independent filmmaker. Some of her friends were already dating men who would become famous. They married princes, Russian princes, such as Prince Chastavelty, who became kind of important in diplomatic circles, and especially in Berlin after the war with the Russian defectors. He spoke Russian. So a lot of these men already, they picked men who would be kind of distinguish themselves later on. Also at Miss Porter School, I mean, later on, there were President Bush's daughter, Dorothy, for example, was there. She had incredibly... There were incredible classmates and schoolmates that she had around her, and most of these girls married quite well. Princess Peggy Bedford, who was also Standard Oil heiress, was also at Miss Porter's at the time. Peggy Bedford, who then became bankrupt, and she became Princess Dahrenberg in France, and then the Duchess Duzès, and she was sort of the equivalent of almost a playgirl. She was a very beautiful blonde, I don't know, but she was sort of an illustrious society figure at the time, and much married, and she died in a car crash, like all the playboys at the time. Porfiria Ruby Rosa, and who else died in the Bois de Boulogne outside of Paris. So some of these people did live past lives, and but they were an interesting group of girls and very popular with all the young men at the time at all the important schools and East Coast boarding schools, New England boarding schools.
I actually recently reread Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique, which is often applied to women of the middle class, but I think it also there are parallels in women of the upper class, like Lily, and how she found solace in work after a difficult time in her marriage and in her private life. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes. About Betty Friedan, about Lily Pulitzer. You'd like me to talk about Lily? Right?
About Lily, how Lily's difficulties and how she wound up with the job at the juice stand.
Yes. Well, actually, and I think sort of that goes back to the structure of the book. I did want to say, even though we see Lily at the height of her kind of adulation by her fellow of Palm Beach matrons, and there is a hint that she will soon become a national star, but what I wanted to say right then and there in the beginning, that all this came, even though her clothes are such cheery, happy, euphoric, almost childlike, joyous creations, they were born from actually a fairly difficult childhood and a difficult early adulthood. And and I think that a lot of these, she was sort of, in a way, just like Betty Friedan. Betty Friedan basically had everything, too, a woman would want at the time she became so restless and realized there's got to be more to this. I think Lily, was married at age 18, at age 20. So, and almost immediately she had, in 4 years, she had three babies. So she had three children. And after the third child, she fell into a major depression and what they called a nervous collapse. So she was hospitalized for 4 months, after which the doctor said, you've got to do something. And she said, well, what can I do? I don't have much of an education. I've always had my nannies and my mummy do everything for me, make all my decisions. But while she was in the hospital, she did do some sketching, and she's always been talented with, she had a good sense of proportion, and people have seen these early drawings, and that she really had a talent for color, proportion, scale. And so, however, she didn't know what to do at all. And all of a sudden, she had this brainstorm that she's got to do something immediately. The doctor said, you've got to do something. No, you can't just idly be idle. And she did feel, I think, this depression was also came about. She was very lonely in Palm Beach. Palm Beach in those days, she and Peter were very different from their other wealthy friends in that they stayed there year-round, because he had to for the orange groves and for his business. And Palm Beach would get very lonely with the hurricane season. Everything was shuttered up. There were only about 5 stores open. It was very different from what it is today, and where today a lot of people do live there all year-round, but in those days it was not. And so that added to this feeling of helplessness, and all her friends, she missed her friends up north. So she started, she didn't know what to do, and she decided she would start her own business. Whatever she was going to do, she would start her own business. Mm-hmm. But the first step to that was actually, she still had to depend on her husband for the oranges. So she decided to open an orange juice stand, which is very unusual in a place like Palm Beach with all the greatest luxury goods merchants on Worth Avenue, both sides, in their pink coral and marble stores. And so she had this humble little orange juice stand where she was juicing the oranges. They would arrive every morning. Peter would fly them down from his, they would get up at dawn, 5 o'clock, and he would fly up to bring her crates of fresh oranges. And she was juicing these oranges on the corner and barefoot, but in pretty white linen outfits, and of course the orange juice would splatter all over. And she decided she had to figure out something that would be like an apron, but she didn't want it to be, you know, sort of like she didn't want it to be an apron. So she decided she went to the Five and Dime, bought some fabric, very cheap cotton fabric, and had her dressmaker sew them up into sleeveless little shifts. She called them little nothing dresses that you could unzip in the heat, because of course it was in the tropics, bending down, squeezing, cutting up the oranges, and the juice would run down her arms. She needed something very practical, and that's how these little shifts were born. And it was not an original shape, the A-line. It was basically an A-line dress, but she slit them up higher for more movement, and she often wore these dresses with the back sort of somewhat unzipped. I don't think she wore a bra, which was part, whether that was rebellion or just the heat. I don't think it was a Betty Friedan kind of feminist statement. I don't think there was ever any real feminist talk coming from her, but basically she was a rebellious person against this regimented sort of propriety that was expected of her. And she did actually, this was in the 60s and 70s, when it was not very fashionable to say you were a debutante. To some extent, she was sort of like a rich hippie of her time, but I think she was always very humble and never really, and quite modest even about her own achievements. So this juicing of oranges became kind of a daily party or sort of a picnic. It had a picnic spirit about it, and there was always music. But once she started wearing these little shifts, all her friends wanted to. It looked rather wonderful on her. She looked like a Gauguin painting, or a South Seas girl with her long black hair and her gypsy earrings and running around barefoot, she tan. She looked very good. She and so everyone wanted to have a little dress like hers. And then people came down during the height of the season, and they took, you know, tens of these dresses with them back to other northern resorts and wore them in Grosse Pointe or Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard, mostly East Coast Atlantic islands off Massachusetts, and on Long Island and Southampton, East Hampton. That's where the clothes were sort of popularized. And the next thing she knew, she... Lord and Taylor, Saks Fifth Avenue, and Bendel's, all these sort of prestigious shops at the time wanted her dresses. So she had no experience, no business experience, but her older sister introduced her to a former editor of Harper's Bazaar, Laura Robbins, who did help her sort of how to, with the fashion cycle, how to deliver things to the stores and how to actually find people to help her with her fabrics, how to establish a factory in Miami. And this was during the time of the Cuban Castro's time. Castro took over Cuba, and there were an enormous number of Cuban refugees. And many of her the seamstresses she first employed, she always wanted to help friends who became charge, who opened boutiques for her across the country as she started opening boutiques. But all this was really, I think she had very good help from her husband in this, and he had a good business sense, and I imagine they had professional help in, but a lot of this was just sort of very ad hoc, and they opened boutiques. I mean, they didn't fully register, and she didn't trademark her, she didn't have a trademark yet, and her clothes were already copied by other people, and so a lot of this happened sort of almost happenstance. But Laura Robbins really helped her, because she knew the fashion press as a former fashion editor at in New York, and she knew the so she knew how to get publicity for these clothes, and also she knew heads of department stores. But it was not an official partnership, and eventually it seemed that the press was more interested in Lily than in Laura, and so the partners broke up after a while. But Laura was very influential and very helpful in helping establish her as a fashion phenomenon of the 60s.
So we're going to fast forward a bit, because I really want to get this question, and this is my messy question that I told you about earlier. So Lily was enormously successful for a while, and then the business folded, and then they brought it back later on. So
yes.
I've recently had the pleasure of reading several interviews with, of doing several interviews with biographers who are writing about the lives of women in fashion. So we've got Coco Chanel, Diana Vreeland, and now Lily Pulitzer. And I've noticed that in each of these women's lives, there was a comeback in later life. So can you talk about Lily's comeback within her own life, but then also the idea of a comeback in the fashion industry? If this is, when you read these three lives, it, not that it makes it look simple, but it makes it seem like it's an industry where you can easily do this, and I don't think it is. So can you talk about that a bit?
Yes. Actually, it's highly unusual. It's just the opposite, that fashion is such a fickle business, and many other people have tried to come back, or people have tried to bring back former labels. I think it was when Laura Ashley, for example, died, I think people tried to bring back her brand, and it was another era. And those wonderful garden party dresses of the English countryside dresses were perfect for their time. But her Little Prince is still, I think, successful as wallpaper. I think it, and but her actual clothes never really came back. Now, most recently, Sarah Jessica Parker and the Weinstein brothers tried to bring back the Halston label, which Halston was very popular in the disco era, and Liza Minnelli, Elizabeth Taylor were fans, and that was impossible. They've tried to bring an enormous amount of effort went into bringing it back. It just failed. I think the only one other person other than what you, the people you mentioned, Diane Furstenberg came back with her wrap dresses, which were also in the early 70s fashion. And but Diane Furstenberg was never really out of the limelight. She wrote books on beds and I think dining rooms and entertainment. She was always somewhat in the limelight as a personality, so she never fully closed her business down. But Lily did. Lily experienced a series of very difficult things, difficult events. Her sister committed suicide, and there was a very messy divorce with Peter Pulitzer, which hit the scandal sheets every day. Not so much her divorce, but actually his divorce from his second wife, so which she was very concerned about her children being exposed to some of the sleazy stuff at the time, which literally made daily headlines as Peter Pulitzer and his second wife, Roxanne, were fighting over the custody of their children. And then all of a sudden, her own, these bright, colorful dresses in the 1980s were sort of eclipsed by they were sort of beside the point. All leisure was beside the point. It was a time of women wanting to sit in the boardrooms, wanting to wear pinstriped pantsuits, high-shouldered power dresses, sort of also what Margaret Thatcher wore. Those they wore skirts, but it was dressed for success. That was the era of the 1980s. And so Lily closed down her business in, I believe, it was in the mid-1980s. Suddenly, I don't have the date. She was happy about it. She was married to her second husband, a Cuban lawyer, and her second marriage actually was the love of her life. And it's a very romantic part of my book because he was quite an Enrique Rousseau was quite an extraordinary person, American educated Cuban from one of the large Cuban families, very international, very worldly, and had the same zest for life that Lily did. So she did. They did have a very happy 22-year marriage. Anyway, after unfortunately Enrique died too soon, but that was the great love of her life. And even though most people sort of remember the Peter Pulitzer partnership because they were very photogenic together with Peter. Anyway, so she experienced sort of several kind of tragedies at the time, including the death, you know, the illness and death of her beloved second husband. When she kind of was just sort of shrugged her shoulder when she closed down, and she said, "Well, I did it for 25 years. Maybe it's time to quit and enjoy being a mother, a grandmother, and a wife." And she and Enrique built this wonderful jungly house in a sort of almost forgotten corner of Palm Beach with access to the Atlantic Ocean and a tiny little creek running through it. And so she always had, she took on all these Cuban, she was very attracted to the Cuban way of cooking and the fun, and Latin Americans always know how to have fun. And she always enjoyed giving parties, so every Sunday she would have hundreds of people come to her buffets with Enrique, all her, even her children's ex-husbands, her stepchildren. So she actually had a very full life. But when out of the blue, two Harvard MBAs, two very attractive young men, James Bradbeer and Scott Beaumont, approached her to revive her brand. Again, she kind of fought them a little. She didn't want to do it. They had to make seven visits to Florida to convince her to open up her, to revive her business and her clothes. And all of a sudden, I guess the more they came, she did like them, and the more they came, the more she realized that she missed being involved with making creative or working with these wonderful colors, color combinations. And so she finally agreed. But what motivated these two young men is that by this time, there was sort of a revival, her vintage lilies were flying off the eBay, and a whole new generation sort of had a hunger for these colorful or appreciation for these vintage lilies. So they all of a sudden it seemed like the zeitgeist was right again for these color was coming back, because initially when lilies started, that was sort of a time where there was a hunger for color after, you know, those post-World War years. There was, of course, London had all those colorful clothes, wonderful music. There was a little more sensuousness, and I think today, with the world being sort of such a serious and difficult place, I think these happy clothes, and she seems to be this revival by Sugartown. The two young men had a corporation called Sugartown, which in recent years was bought by yet a larger corporation called Oxford Industries in Atlanta. These two young men came from Philadelphia, Scott Beaumont, and Sugartown is in Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia. But they were recently, in the year 2010, bought by Oxford Industries. And so I think it's still widening and growing, and it is very popular, and it has grown, expanded into all sorts of licensing of sunglasses, sheets, tablecloths, and of course a lot more menswear, and especially children's clothes are very popular. And so I think but going back to the second life of fashion editors and fashion people, actually I think it's almost a brutally difficult industry. There are so many stars who sort of come and shine for a few years and then disappear. And so it is highly unusual that Diana Vreeland was able to, she was a legendary editor, of course, but she was only at Harper's Bazaar at Harper's Bazaar she was there for many, many years, but she was editor-in-chief of Vogue for only about 9 years. And it was the absolute apex of Vogue's doing very unusual things, covering youth culture and very exciting color pages, exotic color pages, exotic models such as Penelope Tree, Verushka. Mrs. Vreeland did have a wild imagination. I did know her because she was just leaving Harper's Bazaar when I first went there as a junior fashion copywriter, so I do remember her, and she was a very colorful character, every bit as colorful. But the fact that she was able to have this second career at the Metropolitan Museum, which was actually a very quiet part, the fashion department of the Metropolitan Museum was at the time a very quiet division of the museum, and that she would make it something very alive with her yearly big fashion, mounting these enormous fashion shows, such as Russian peasants or the Habsburg Empire, and she would or revive some of the early French couturiers, or show on Saint Laurent. I mean, she made it something very alive, and I think it's all the more hats off to her that she was able to do this, because it's quite unusual. I know a lot of very, very creative fashion editors who sort of go into the night and you never hear from them, and I'm having actually a very hard time making ends meet, especially because fashion changes so much, and it actually also wants new, it thrives on discovering new personalities, both as editors, both as and certainly as designers. Designers don't always have such a long life, I think, in modern times.
Thank you so much for talking with us today about Lily. Any idea who you're going to be writing about next?
Yes, actually, I am now editing a book on of also somewhat of this Kennedy era is a book about John Carl Warnecke, the architect of Camelot. He did the Camelot. He did the Kennedy grave in Arlington and was very close to the, so it's an inside look at the Kennedy era, but he was particularly those the last days of doing the grave, how difficult it was to do that eternal same grave, but also he was going to be, President Kennedy promised him the Kennedy Library and all the intrigues because architects from all over the world wanted to do that, but, and he brought in his close friend, Warnecke brought in his close friend, I.M. Pei, who, of course, totally charmed the Kennedy women. He ended up doing the Kennedy Library in Boston, which is in the news right now. And so it's, but it's full of very interesting characters, intriguing love stories behind the scenes. And so, and John Carl Warnecke then was the first romance Mrs. Kennedy had after her husband's death. They worked very closely on the grave and the library and all other things. And they, he's also the designer of the, at the time he was designing the Hawaii had just become a brand new American state, the last of the new states. And he was designing the state capital of Hawaii. So it's an architectural story. I have a lot of background writing about architecture and design, so this seems to be a natural. I do want to, after that, I would like to write about magazines and an inside book on magazines, and I can't figure out whether I should do it as fiction or as a but that's really the big project coming up. But I may do it as fiction, but with sort of real figures sort of sprinkled throughout, well-known figures sprinkled throughout. So, but it, I think it, I have not decided yet.
Well, it sounds like you have some good possibilities.
Yes, I think it's a very intriguing story because we've had, of course, The Devil Wears Prada, which is kind of tongue-in-cheek and funny. But, you know, there is there are some serious things about the magazine world that, that have never been. One of them is what happens to people when they leave this magazine world, you know? They it is very hard to get your next job. You can go into public relations. But having lived in this glamorous world of expense accounts, rubbing shoulders with celebrities, what happens next, you know? And also the dichotomy in many people's lives, you know, these glossy, the glossy life of magazines and their private lives, and it's not good on marriages, and so forth. So there's a lot. There's a lot that has not been written about. There's the, of course, there's a lot of fun and glamour and fizz and good times, and so it could. I think it has a lot of potential. So that's really what I'm thinking about. I'm finished. I'm getting very close to finishing the book about the architect. So that's my next plan.
Brilliant! Thank you so much for joining us today. I've been talking today with Catherine Livingston about Lily Pulitzer, Palm Beach Tropical Glamour, and the Birth of a Fashion Legend. I'm Oline Eaton. This is New Books in Biography. Thanks for listening.